have anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I can just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 22, The Delphi Trial Explained. This week, Bob was joined by Bob Mata from the Defense Diaries podcast, and the Bobs had a great conversation about what was happening during the almost month-long Delphi trial. This episode drummed up a lot of questions, and today I'm joined by Bob and Janet, as well as special guest Bob Mata, as we try to get these all answered. Before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
We do now. So I just want to, this is how we're going to handle all these conversations, Janet, that we were having beforehand about the recordings and who's doing what. This is how we're going to handle that. Hello, listeners. This is a clusterfuck of a way for us to record all of this. So you don't need to know how or why. I just want to tell you that if the sound quality doesn't come out as good as it normally is, that's not Erica's fault. It's because of the way that we're going to handle this situation. And also,
hey, Bob, blame Bob.
You blame one of the Bobs for sure.
I know which Bob I'm blaming, and exactly. It ain't Mata.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
So, just want to let you guys know about that. It probably won't be an issue. You won't even know. But I'm sitting here thinking about the 50 different ways to juggle this, and we're just going to go with this track right here, and that's what it's going to be. So, if there's little glitches, it's fine. We are joined by Bob Mata today. We have a ton to talk about. Janet does have a hard out. She's trying to make a little bit of a softer out at the end of this, and we've got so much to get through. So, I want you guys to know that it was at their request that Zach and Janet said, why don't we skip asking you guys what you think about the episode and get right into the question? Because there was, 50 questions, Janet, that came out?
There's a lot of questions. We're not going to be able to get to everything. And so many of them were just like very choice questions with really great, juicy answers. So we'll see where we get.
Right. Awesome. So I'm going to kill about 2 minutes here, giving a little bit of ramble, and then we're going to start.
Allie's in the chat, too. So, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, Allie's in the chat.
Oh, hey, Allie. Allie's there, too. This is great. Yeah.
Hey,
so we have
Allie.
We have a lot to get through. So first of all, big thanks to Bob Mata for taking another hour to come in and chat with us and answer a lot of your guys' questions. I do want to let you guys know before we dig into this too much. And of course, I know, Bob, you saw this in the group too. There's people like this case, just like any other case, that have their heels dug in on one side or the other and are, you know, well, you only had a defense guy on and you should have had the other side on, which I thought was a little silly because like I never even asked you your opinion. I was just asking about the things that happened at trial.
Bob, that is my life in this case.
Yeah,
that's our lives in every case. That has been my life in this case. I've never given an opinion. Like when you asked me, I'm like, I have no idea. I wasn't there. I don't know if he did it or he didn't do it. Like I'm not dug in on a position. All I can comment on is the process. Like the process that took place was fucked. Like I don't know what else. Like that's the easiest way I could put it, and the most succinct.
And we do have a bunch of very specific questions. And that was the big thing for me was I had specific questions. But just to as an attempt, just so you guys know this is out there, I did shoot a message over to Andrea Burkhart because that's somebody that some people said there was another lawyer that was there and invited her to come on and have a similar discussion just so people can feel like it's balanced. I'm happy to hear. I haven't heard back from her yet, so I don't know.
Oh, no, she's more defense-oriented than I am.
Oh, so she's the wrong
one. Yeah, she's not the one, dude. Like you need to get what I would love for you to do is get the murder sheet on with me. Like, they're very pro-prosecution. They're
the ones who've been, sheet.
Yeah, they're flame-throwing me. They've done, three hit pieces, just three straight up hit pieces they put out on their podcast on me, like saying that I was a shill for the defense, that I was working with them. I was paid to promote. It was all this bullshit. It was unbelievable. Just blatant lies about me. I've been trying to speak with them because they, for whatever reason, they won't communicate with me. And guess who they're buddied up with? You get one guess, Bob.
I bet you I know.
We don't have to do that. We don't have to.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to say it. We don't speak their names here, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, well, that's who they're palled up with, so.
All right. So all that being said, I will reach out to them too. Hell, I'll, I, like, I just, yeah. If people feel like that wasn't balanced, we'll give them balance. But I just want you guys all to know that, yeah, I heard that. I've reached out to some people to see if we can have another somebody else to come on to talk about it. I don't want this to become a Delphi podcast. It was just an episode because it's a case that all three of us, four obviously, kind of Bob, are very passionate about and want to hear what went on there. But I think that the best thing for us to do is just start getting right into these questions, because a lot of these questions, Bob's joining us because a lot of them are questions that Bob's going to be able to answer and I'm not. So JB, I'll let you take it from here.
Okay, sure. And I'll preface this by saying I did see some notes from people in our follow-up post saying, like, why didn't you guys talk about this? Why didn't you talk about that? Just a reminder that that was 1 hour, a little over an hour. And you can absolutely hear a lot of what you said wasn't covered. You can definitely hear Bob and Allie talk about it. So I think there were things that were, you know, as, again, people had their heels dug in, there were folks who were like, how conspicuous that you didn't mention this. And I will just say, whether or not you think that they have a bias about it, they absolutely talked about it. And to ears, we're just talking about what happened. So you're not going to get everything here, nor were you going to get everything on the one episode that the Bobs did. But that information is out there for you guys to check out.
Yeah, I mean, they did. You guys did what, 60 some hours or close to it?
At least.
Yeah. And you know, I had Bob for an hour. And also, if anybody has any, you know, issues with what did come out or didn't come out, that's on me, not on Bob. I drove the conversation. I asked the questions I wanted and for me, it was just, I wanted to talk to someone who I trust, who was there in the courtroom, that could answer the very specific questions that I had about the evidence, you know. And you heard those questions come out through. It's like, I want to know, where was the bullet found? Cause I didn't have the 60 hours to listen to all of it. So I'm lucky enough to be friends with Bob and come like, hey, where was it? You know, the questions like that.
Well, and I saw the one person, and I know exactly which comment you're talking about. It's the guy who's like, oh, well, I find it convenient that Bob didn't mention the fact that the defense's expert on cross-examination said that if he had examined the bullet himself, that he may have decided that it was a sufficient agreement as well. And of course he would have said that. Like I wasn't trying to hide that. I mean, like unless the guy examines it, that always is going to be a possibility. Like any expert's always going to answer as honestly as they can.
Yeah.
And he couldn't possibly say no because he didn't examine the bullet.
Right. He doesn't know.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, so yeah, it's just like, I think people think I'm more dug in into the Richard Allen is innocent camp because they just don't know what my content is. You know, it's like I'm talking about the process. And I'm talking about the way that we treated a pretrial detainee in this country was jacked up, and that we can't allow that to become the norm in this country. And people have just conflated that into me being some giant pro Allen innocent guy, which, again, I don't know. If I ever get to dig into all the evidence, then I'll come to a real conclusion on that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If I'm able to get my hands on the whole case file and all the discovery, I can dig into it. And, you know, and I've had conversations with the man's wife, who knows him better than anybody on the planet and who is as salt of the earth as you can get. And, you know, I mean, like, I know what her opinion is on it, you know, and I know what her opinion of her husband is in terms of him being capable of committing a crime like this. Cause this is like this is the real McCoy shit, man. Like you don't get any more horrific than this.
Right.
No, that's like 35 years and kind of just having the blinders on to your husband being a monster like that seems improbable. And like, there's no part of me that thinks that Kathy is like pulling the wool over my eyes. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, I asked her a very genuine question and she gave me a very genuine answer. And that was post-conviction after she heard all the evidence. You know, I'm like, I asked her flat out and, you know, she's like, there's no way for this. So
yeah, some of that's subjective, but you're also having that experience. And then most of us aren't having that experience where you get to have that conversation. And, you know, you've been very honest about saying, like, based on what I heard in the trial, this doesn't seem like the guy, but you've also said the whole time I wasn't there, this could be the guy. It was not presented in a way that made me feel confident at all about it, that you just did not feel good about the verdict, but he's also been very respectful about the verdict that came. So what I was tasked with was, of course, going through all of these many questions. What I ended up trying to do was sort of lean onto stuff that maybe I didn't hear you and Allie cover as much, because I would like to be able to direct people to your content for the stuff that I know you've kind of gone over. But then there were also people who, like, there were so many questions from our listeners who aren't as familiar with the case that I was like, okay, maybe I should pick a couple of those that we can try to just do like a little summation of some of the questions.
Anything and everything you want. There's nothing off.
Great. Okay. So, well, one thing that I did think was handy, and I appreciated Stacy posting this, was just clarifying that you had mentioned when you were talking to Bob that the photo of Abby might be one of the biggest mysteries of the case. But she said that if Libby took the photo using the Snapchat app and posted it, but did not choose to save it separately to her phone, then it's actually not a mystery because that's how the app works. Does that ring true for you guys? I don't know. I also am not a Snapchat user, but maybe it really is as simple as like, yeah, if it posted, it goes out there. But if you don't choose to save it, it doesn't stay on your phone.
I think that that's how it works, but I don't think it's that simple. Like, I think that in terms of, because the way it is, it's a setting on Snapchat as opposed to on your phone where you can choose, because like kind of what drew kids to Snapchat was the ability to be able to take a picture and then it disappears. All the evidence is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a setting on there where it can save to your photos. I think what Cellebrite saw was that, because it went into the deeper extraction. So, which I think dug into the Snapchat. I don't know that they got into that at trial. Like, we didn't get into the weeds about how this picture could have been disappeared. And that's really coming from the state's quote unquote expert, Chris Cecil. Like, those were questions that were asked of him. Like, well, how we know that this picture exists in the world. Okay. And we know that it was posted to Snapchat because people grabbed it, took screen grabs of it out there. And we know that it existed, yet there's no evidence that it was ever taken on Libby's phone. And so then the next question was posed, is it possible that somebody had access to Libby's account on a different device? You know, I could log on to any Snapchat. And that they took the photo, and that's where it exists in the world. So, I mean, the honest answer is like, I can't give an answer because they didn't delve into that specifically at trial in terms of kind of the nuts and bolts. Because I had to ask my 18-year-old daughter how Snapchat works. That's how I found out what that last question was talking about in terms of what happens with pictures.
It seems like even if the photo isn't on the phone, which is what this listener's saying, it seems like there would still be some sort of like backdoor log that Snapchat has.
Well, Marge says in the chat, she said the phone had other snaps and that photo wasn't in the snap cache.
Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking. There's has to be accurate? Like a...
Yeah, well, the snap cache they got through the, you know, the advanced, like, so they had done a couple of extractions and the advanced one, the logical one, I think, was the second one they did. And then they did the advance, which was the full extraction. And then they were able to see the snap cache. So, and I think that it showed certain pictures, but it still doesn't answer the question. If they didn't save it to the phone, does it show what, like, they didn't get into the weeds about how Snapchat operates. You know what I mean? Okay. It reminds me of the Karen Reed thing. Like, why can't anybody give us the answer at what time that goddamn phrase was actually typed? Why can't any of the experts in the world, why can't one person that exists on the planet just answer the question definitively, what time was that phrase? And it felt like kind of the same thing with this, where they just didn't put on at somebody who was an expert in Snapchat, who can explain to all of us, like, if you're over 25, you have no idea how Snapchat works. And that was like everybody in that courtroom.
I'm still trying to figure out how to update my MySpace page. I want to put a song on it.
We don't have time for your antics. We have too many questions to get.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Next.
I am not intentionally trying to be slippery on that at all.
That's one of those things where it doesn't, to me, that doesn't say anything about anything. Like, it could be Richard Allen and the Snapchat thing could be a mystery, and it could not be Richard Allen and the Snapchat thing could be a mystery. To me, that's not, there's, for me personally, I find it very interesting, and it doesn't tell me one way or another anything about.
It's just weird that this picture's out there and we don't know where it came from.
Right. It's weird. It's weird.
Yeah. It's wild. Lots and lots of questions and comments about Richard Allen's mental state, his health. Walla was a real sticking point for a lot of people. Valeria, for example, says, why were the sessions with Wallet not recorded when Richard Allen was being filmed 24/7? Is this normal practice? Is it a HIPAA thing? Like, what do you know why that wasn't a thing?
I don't know why it wasn't a thing. And it's a great question because they recorded him walking to the cage. And what it might have been, because what we learned was that the camcorder that they were using actually did have sound, where the warden, the first time that that camcorder came up back in June of 23 during the first safekeeping hearing, where they were trying to get Allen out of the prison and Gull denied it. And they brought up the fact that they were recording him with this camcorder. The warden on the stand said, just flat out lied and said that the camcorder didn't have sound. It came out at trial that it did have sound. And Rosie, one of the defense attorneys, went to go play it with sound. And when Gull caught wind of the fact that there was sound, she's like, whoa, shut it down. She's like, I didn't know it had sound. I'm not allowing any sound because I haven't heard it. I don't know what was said. And they made them reconfigure the videos they were going to show and get rid of the sound. So in terms of why the actual sessions were, whether or not they were filmed, we don't know. I can't say one way or another. I don't remember it being testified to, but we certainly were not shown in any of the videos with Walla. It seems that that would have been the best evidence. Right. To me, it would indicate if the defense had the audio and knowing that she destroyed her handwritten notes and all we have left of what she's saying that Richard Allen said to her are the notes that she typed into the database. It would have seemed to me if a video existed with sound of those interviews that the defense would have fought very, very hard to get them in order to right. be able to compare and contrast if Richard Allen said the things that she claims that he said with respect to the smoking gun confession. So it never was brought up. And I tend to think that they don't exist because that didn't happen. And I never heard a motion being filed regarding getting those videos in. So
Susan and somebody else in the chat just popped in actually it was Richard. I think I'm going to get back to what Susan said, but Richard had said, is this true? He said that they were recording him with his lawyers. Is that true?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. true. That came out in that first safekeeping hearing. And if you guys don't know what a safekeeping hearing, essentially when Richard Allen was first taken into custody, it was one of the first things that like set off red flags in my head is that, you know, without him having a lawyer, Allen wasn't appointed a lawyer at that point, and he wasn't present in court when they went in and got a safekeeping order entered, which is a substantive motion that you file with the court and where you're having a judge say, okay, we need this guy kept safely, which means that we can transfer him to a prison. So mm-hmm. that was done without his presence in court and without him having an attorney, obviously violating his due process rights, and which ultimately ended up keeping him in prison as opposed to a county jail, which is where primarily pretrial detainees are kept for 13 months. And, you know, we all, I talked about it ad nauseum last time about the effects on him psychologically were devastating, you know, to the point where if I were to kind of try to create a short synopsis of what my overarching theme the last time that we spoke, Bob, would be pretty simple. That cannot be the norm in this country, that we right. start taking people that we have alleged to commit crimes and then torture them psychologically by putting them in a prison and cutting them off from their safety nets, you know, whoever their support system is. In this case, it's his wife, Kathy, who he's been married to for 35 years, who he leans on heavily just on a day-to-day basis in terms of kind of the other things that he has going on in terms of his mental illness, you know, and just shutting that down to the point where he goes quite literally psychotic. And then they start injecting him with Halidol. I mean, we can't become that country like that. We're you know, and it's like, I think what I said on the last time I said, I wish more than anything in the world that I could trust this verdict, but they made that impossible for me because I'm an intellectually honest person. Like, you can't think that that's okay. And like, if you're looking at the situation that it was these extracted confessions happened in, which could be true, but I can't trust them because of the way they went about getting them.
Right.
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 Problem with it, man. It's like, just if he would have been spilling his guts when he was just sitting in Cass County Jail, we would not be having this conversation. I'd be like, yeah, sounds like he decayed, you know?
Yeah.
You brought up the Halidol injections and that treatment. How soon after those did the confessions come? Because I feel like they kind of went hand in hand, did they not?
They were all in the same 3-month period from April to the beginning of June. And that was all during the time that he was completely psychotic. So the first shot comes in early April. That's when they bring in the doctor, the psychiatrist to come in, and he administers it. And that was the Dr. Martin. And he came in and said, yeah, this guy's psychotic. We've got to give him involuntary injections. And they all happened during that time frame. Yeah. So he was in there from either late October, depending on who you believe, late October, the very beginning of November. And then these things start happening 5 months later. All right. So he's in there in solitary for 5 months. And during that time, he does not lay eyes on Kathy Allen, his wife. So like that's why I keep trying to impress upon people. This is a guy who's presumed innocent, that's ripped out of his life, thrown into a prison, and is cut off from any real contact from anybody that would matter to him. I mean, like, I just want people to try to wrap their mind around what that would do to you psychologically. And like I think I said this on the last episode, like the defense witness who actually examined him, who was a very, like, I think her name was Walcott or Westcott. It's slipping my mind at this point. But the way she defined him was that he was a fragile egg coming in. So because he had the major depressive disorder and the anxiety that pre-existed, that existed since like late childhood. Like, this wasn't something that cropped up after the murders, because believe me, had he developed the depression after the murders, the state would have used that ad nauseum. You know, he'd be like, oh, like,
right.
So no, right. This is something that had been going on his whole life. So he gets there, and he really does depend on Kathy to, like, to keep him upright. You know, he gets very depressed. He feels like he has no self-worth a lot of times, and Kathy always has to, like, bolster him up, you know? So it's like you've got this guy that goes in there, and they knew they needed to break him because he had held so firm during the two preceding interrogations on the 13th and the 26th of October. Like, all of these are going to be made, like, I'll feel so vindicated that, like, when the world can just see what went on with this guy,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't me trying to have an angle. This is me just looking at it. I have no horse in the race. You know what I mean? It's like, I didn't represent him. He's not my client. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, I just feel that I'm in great fear that we have a wrongful conviction here. And until I'm able to dig into everything that comes along with that case file, like, then I'll know. No, you know, like, right now, I just feel like it was a railroad job, whether he was innocent or guilty. He was railroaded.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they crammed him through it was that situation where, like, just give me a guy and I'll make the case fit. It was that thing that you see.
Right.
You know, which are terrifying ways to come, you know, go about convicting people in this country. We don't want it to be that way. Just give me
especially when you're potentially putting the families through appeals and all. I mean, the more ammunition you have to show that the rules were not followed, it was a wrongful conviction, it could have been a wrongful conviction even if it's a guilty person, you are dragging the families through all of that again. So get it right. Just get it right.
That was,
you know, and don't cheat.
That was it's thing, yeah, for 2 years. Like, exactly that sentiment that you just said is literally was what I was pounding my fist on the table saying. That was it. I'm like people just are not understanding that the trial is only the beginning of this process. Like, a conviction is only the beginning of this process. If people think that this case is going to go away, they're living in a fantasy world. And I kept explaining to people, I'm like, the only thing that could potentially outweigh the number of errors that Judge Gull made in this case which are massive, is going to be the fact if the appellate court says, look, the guy confessed X amount of times. We find that those are way too compelling, that even though the judge may have made mistakes here, that because of those confessions, that it wouldn't have mattered what you put on in a third party defense, that those were never going to sway a jury beyond those confessions, what they did, in which case they're going to say, we find those all to be harmless error. So the attack is going to have to be from the appellate level on the confessions, the conditions of the confinement. The question then becomes, did they do enough in the pretrial via motions being filed to preserve the issue properly for them to be able to argue it to the appellate court? Like, that's because that's where it's going to lay for them. Like, I mean, ultimately with the appellate lawyers. But to your point, Janet, I mean, that's the gospel. I mean, you have to be cognizant. Like, Gall at some point had to think about, okay, if I keep ruling like this and just keep handling this case the way that I am, is there a high likelihood that I'm going to torture these poor families to have to go through this shit again? Guilty or innocent, like you said, that's irrelevant. It's just the process of going through it, and just the unknown is always the thing that we fear the most. And when you're sitting there as a family member through a trial like that, it's just gut-wrenching. It's a gut-wrenching experience. And it was the same thing for Kathy Allen as to her husband. You know, both sides are feeling the kind of intense pressure that I don't know that you can replicate in any other scenario that exists on our planet. I mean, there's just nothing more intense than a trial like that, where everything's at stake, where liberty or sometimes life is at stake. And you know, and it's left the 12 individuals that go back there. And like I said, I mean, like they were presented with more than enough for that conviction because of the confessions. You know, I mean, if you strip those confessions out, I have a very different answer for you, because I don't think they have nearly enough to have convicted him if you strip those confessions away.
Let's keep punching along, because we have 50 questions. We've been through one.
I know. I know. We knew it was going to be hard. We knew it was going to be hard. And some of the stuff was kind of getting answered along the way. Like, definitely, yep. Manu had asked a question about, you know, how is this going to be attacked? Is it going to be possible to attack the confessions and Wallace credibility? And will that, you know, be something that comes up in the appeals process? And we've just answered yes. Those are going to be things that are absolutely hammered into, because they have to be. Okay. I'm just going to have to kind of get through some of this. Richard, I just want to acknowledge quickly, it did get mentioned. It got mentioned in the chat. I see you're here. I know Ali had kind of drawn a circle around it as well. Bob, you mentioned it, not just being cut off from people, but just the very existence of being in a situation in which they never turn the lights off. That's enough. For me, that would be enough. Like, I would lose my mind.
Because he was on suicide watch, they had the lights on 24/7.
The state's response to that was like, oh, but he could dim them.
I don't know what they said,
but he could dim the lights. You know,
I can't sleep with my wife's Scentsy candle turned on at night.
Dude, I mean, it was complete sensory deprivation, just to like kind of build on what Plunkett's saying a bit. You know, I mean, yeah, the lights being on 24/7 is psychotic inducing from certain. You're talking about like cinder brick walls, like a sliver of a window that you couldn't see through. I mean, you're talking about literally like a padded cell without the padding on it, where there's just nothing in there to inspire you to use your mind in any capacity. So you're just going to sit there ruminating over whatever you're ruminating about,
right,
as your mind slips away from you.
No, for sure. I mean, yeah, as somebody who's gone through dissociation as a younger person, that I can't tell you how quickly my brain would break. I can't tell you. I would say anything. I would say anything to get out of a room. And that's one of the reasons I think I'm so drawn to this kind of work and false confessions, is that and one of the things that concerns me about this case, and then we'll move on from the mental health stuff, is as you were describing what was being shown to the jury, my biggest fear, and I don't feel like we talked about it quite that much, was that people have still such a stigma around mental illness in general, that showing that someone is psychotic is unfortunately going to be tied to those crimes. And I know people tried to separate them during the trial, but the whole time that was happening, I was like, this feels like a risk to me, because if you're a person who hasn't been exposed to those kinds of pressures and that kind of mental illness to know that there's a difference between someone who's very depressed and someone who acts out aggressively and wants to hurt other people. That there's a difference between, yes, eating your own feces. That sounds like something a crazy person will do. And people think crazy people also murder young girls. I was very, very nervous that there would be members of the jury that would think, this guy seems like a total nut. Of course he's going to kill two young girls. So that's one of the problems with this case, has so much tangled up in it. And mental illness is such a huge problem in the way we deal with it in this country and the way we talk about it, that was a real uphill battle. Having to prove that he was broken and then other people potentially using that against him just to say, look at what a crazy guy this is. What a killer he must be.
Right. And you're dead on there. And when we finally get to hear from these jurors, if they do decide to come forward, I guarantee you that there's going to be more than one of them that's going to think that they're going to think that he was psychotic prior to, and that it just flamed up again. And you know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to make that short leap that, you know, yeah, okay, well, he's always been some form of psych. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
They just don't have the time in a trial to be able to go through the background and the history of his medical history. And they wouldn't allow them to bring in anything relating to his family history, whether or not there's any mental illness out there with respect to his family, because they were saying, look, no, we're objecting. It's hearsay. And you say, well, what do you mean it's hearsay? Well, it was self-reporting. Whatever Richard Allen told doctors when he was treating about things that his family may have had in terms of conditions isn't his family members saying that, yes, I suffered from depression or schizophrenia, whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, so all of that was blocked from coming in. So we were really left with this truncated portion. But I mean, the reality, Jen, is that they had to do it. Like they had to.
No, for sure. For sure.
Your point is so well taken, because it is that incredibly slippery slope. It just is. It's like, it's like I was saying with like the unspent casing. I don't give a shit how many experts you put on the stand to say it's junk science. The jurors are not going to view it that way. As soon as they see an expert that works for the state police that's saying there was sufficient agreement, the jurors are going to believe it because they want to believe it, because they want to get justice for the girls. It's that simple. Right. It's like these cases aren't complex, like how they get guilty verdicts on these things, you know?
And that they almost always do. Sorry, go ahead.
At the risk of getting this too far derailed again, I thought there was a good question in the chat. A couple people asked, how should a high profile pretrial detainee like this be protected? You know, because that's the argument that I've seen people say is like, yeah, we're talking about these conditions he was in. He was in solitary confinement. They're like, yeah, but he was high profile and he had to be protected. So how would they do that? As briefly as possible, what would be the proper way?
It's a simple answer, and it's a short answer. You keep him in the county jail. You can keep him segregated, but let his wife visit him. He's not convicted. This like he is a pretrial detainee. Any other pretrial detainee can have they visit, whether they're kept in solitary or not. They make arrangements for your spouse or your loved one or your kids, like some sense of normalcy leading into trial. Keep him segregated, fine. He's still going to have more contact in a county jail in terms of having people talking to him who are also going to be similarly situated, wherein they're not convicted felons. Like it's just a different mindset. If you're a convicted felon in the worst pod, in the worst prison in the state, you're going to be a mean motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? Like that's just your mindset. When you're in a county jail with a bunch of people that are awaiting trial, it's a different circumstance. So like, that's the easiest answer. You don't cut him off from his wife. You let Kathy, you keep him in Cass County where Kathy can come once or twice a week and visit him for an hour, whether it's sitting across a glass shield or whatever the case may be, at a table, whatever. At least he's seeing his wife. There's some form of normalcy for him that he can actually lay eyes on her. I mean, that's how you do it. Like in every other case, I've never heard, and my counter argument to those people saying, well, how do they keep every other high profile defendant safe? Like I've never heard of a situation like this ever. If somebody can point out to me another case and another high profile case, they put Gacy, who murdered 33 young boys, they held him in Cermak Memorial Hospital. Like, and this guy was one of the most prolific serial killers of all time. And they found 29 of the bodies buried on his property. So there was little to no doubt that he had done it. And that guy was sitting across a table from his lawyer, my father, like while he was working with them to prepare him for trial. So, I mean, there's ways. Like, Alan should have, I mean, one of my criticisms of the defense is I probably would have challenged his competency to get him out of Westville just by way of having him evaluated to be, you know, his competency evaluated. They're going to have to move him in. It's what we did with Garcia twice to get him to Lincoln Regional, because I just wanted to get him out of the Douglas County Jail because they were torturing him psychologically there. Same shit, never turned the lights off, screaming at him through the walls, wouldn't let him sleep. You know, he was to the point where he's like delusional. He's like, oh, they're raping me, but not physically. It's with like some kind of magical tool that they're inserting without actually inserting. You know, it was like you knew he was gone mentally, you know, and you knew he wasn't malingering, you know, because this whole thing about Alan malingering was so disingenuous by the state. It was disgusting to me. Yeah, he's eating his own shit in order to try to get out of Westville. Like he's malingering, but they were arguing that he was malingering and eating his own feces and doing these, just smashing his head against the brick wall in order to be able to counteract the fact that he was confessing. I'm like, that is just such a circular argument. It doesn't make any sense. Right. I asked anybody to explain it to me in a way that's not circular.
Let's get to more of these questions.
Bob, you brought up the round. And there was, there definitely a lot of pushback on that, but also a lot of agreement on the testing. From my perspective, and maybe this is an echo chamber, maybe I do need to go listen to, I don't know if I can handle the murder sheet, but maybe I do need to go listen to something. Unfortunately, Clemente, I just don't feel like he's covering in any detail. So they're just kind of the same.
Well, I'm just not interested in hearing from anybody that wasn't in the courtroom. Because there's no document, right? For me, it's like, that
I'd
doesn't
love to be
really
opposite
good.
Of Clemente. Like, I mean, is he?
But he wasn't in there, really, so I don't know.
At all?
I don't think he has all the information. So I keep hearing him. What I would hear is him kind of reiterating something that I was like, I feel like we've already proved that that's not what happened. Or I feel like there's a huge chunk of information that's missing that he just doesn't have. So for the round, my takeaway was, and so this is what I'm so confused about when people push back on it, because I am so open to hearing a pro-prosecution person fully explain to me why, when someone said you had to do something different that was not the process that would have had to happen during the crime, in order to match those things, to me, it's over. That part is over. To me, that's not evidence. Guilty or innocent, I don't understand how there are people who walked away feeling like, no, it sufficiently matched because two independent people, one of whom was the boss of the other, but two independent people both looked at it. But I don't understand how on cross, if you say, so what you're saying is you had to do a series of things that empirically did not happen when the crime was being committed in order to get your findings. How is that evidence? I don't understand. Can you please tell me what was said in that room that someone else?
I couldn't say it any better than you just did. Like, it's not evident.
People say that it is. People are like, no, you're misunderstanding it. What? It is a match. They proved it. And I just don't understand how you do that.
How is it a sufficient match? It's an apples to orange comparison.
One thing that I want to chime in real quick, because we do have a somewhat expert in the field in here, because I did see somebody made a comment or one of the questions that was asking if the round was a manufactured round or a reload. Yes. And they were saying that perhaps like a reload could cause different kind of marks.
A reload would have any marking from a prior fired firearm.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah,
it would have any markings on it. Because all a reload does is it resizes the casing. So when that shot is fired, as Bob said in the episode, there's pressure and that casing expands,
mm-hmm.
is expelled backwards out of the chamber, but there's an ejector mark, right? Mm-hmm. But any gun that that's fired on is going to leave a ejector mark. When you reload a firearm, you just resize the casing back to where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. You put a primer in, powder in, projectile in, and it's good to go again. That brass can be fired multiple times, but it's going to have any marking on it that was from any other firearm before that.
So I would assume that it was not a reload at all, or was there been multiple?
Well, there,
were three,
there
you don't know.
There were
three gross marks on it. That thing had been ejected three times that particular round.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, that. Well, so I remember you saying three gross marks. So that's saying right. there was evidence of it being ejected three different times.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So very well. I mean, if it is, I mean, that could have been three times that it was fired, or at least two different times that it was fired, and once through the gun.
Or you have no idea. It could have been a round that he just kept putting in the magazine, and it would, like he said, his testimony is that I would bring the gun out if I went fishing, in fear of the snake, or if I was mushroom hunting. So it basically, anytime he was walking in, you know, forest wooded area with underlay where snakes could be, like he'd bring his gun in case he had to shoot.
Who's he? Snake.
Richard Allen.
He so, testified to that, or is that was
well, no, his... but he gave that. He didn't testify, but it came out during his interrogation.
Okay. Gotcha.
Basically, like he asked him when he would carry his gun. He's like, did you have your gun out there that day? He's like, no. Like I wouldn't bring my gun out there just walking on the bridge on the trails. He's like, I only bring it fishing or if I'm out mushroom hunting. So, you know, I mean, anytime he would carry the gun, theoretically, if he's a safe gun owner, you know, like if he keeps one in the chamber at the ready and when he's out there and then he comes home and he's going to store the gun, he's going to rack it. Thing will pop out. He'll pop it back in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And then, but theoretically, like you guys would know better than I, would that be the top round?
Yes, it would. Yeah. All so if you were to take a gun completely unloaded, put a magazine in, rack it so you have one in the chamber, you would in turn when you came home, take the magazine out, rack it again, that round would come out. And that's, I mean, if you're going to put it back in, it's going right back on top, which would be again the first round back into the chamber.
There you go.
And you're basically always going to do that.
Yeah.
There's right. very seldom you're ever going to take that round out unless for some reason you took that round out and didn't take the magazine out, then it's going to cycle another round in and you're going to have to go through the process again. But right. for the most part, you're going to drop the magazine, rack the round out, put it back in the magazine.
Put it back in.
And then once you go to take it back out, it'll go back in the chamber first.
Yeah. And Janet, I mean, the reality is that the law as it's currently situated in Indiana just does not, they just don't follow Daubert or Frye. Like, you know what I mean? What they've yeah. elected to allow it to go to weight, which is a scary, scary proposition.
But then why isn't third party go to weight? Why doesn't third party go to weight? I don't understand. It's just very, it just seems very weight. I mean, of course, no surprise there, but it just seems like if you have a bunch of bad facts or stupid things about, well, yeah, I know, stupid things that, you know, are so flimsy that you shouldn't be able to bring them, then why is seemingly flimsy evidence where you did a test that actually is different than the thing that would have had to happen. It's just fascinating to me that you could make that ruling that you would be like, okay, well, to me, those have the same weight, but I guess they don't because one side is a prosecution. I don't know. That was very worrisome to me.
No, I mean, it's a terrifying concept because it's like you can make the same argument for whatever this thing that Elvis Field said to Kevin Murphy, the cop, which I certainly right. consider to be some form of a confession, like, hey, even if it's posed as a hypothetical.
If I had spit on, if you found my spit, I don't understand.
Like the shit that he said to his sister yeah. was like specific to things that would have been at the crime scene. Like, how would he have even known that, like, the stick things were happening to say that I put two sticks to kind of look like antlers up around her head?
But
to your point, like, how isn't that going to wait? Like, why is that? Like, why are Richard
if it's stupid,
Allen
then let the jurors go. It's stupid.
Right.
Let them decide also that that has no weight. Let me ask you this question, though, because this is concerning to me. And there were definitely people who, and again, guys, I'm so sorry. I can't shout each one of you out. There were so many thoughtful questions. There were so many that I'm just trying to get the hits, greatest hits in here. People who are asking like, okay.
Jana, I'm so sorry to interrupt yeah. you, but I just want... There was a bunch of people asking in the chat about this. I will post this YouTube video for people to see, but I grabbed Zach and I are both comfortable around firearms. I want to show you guys, for those that are watching, what we're talking about when we're talking about racking
oh, great.
Around.
Cool. Yeah.
So I just went out and got this out of my safe. Here is you have the gun, and then you have your magazine that look like this. And you see the bullet is in the top of the magazine. They're spring loaded in here. So what they're talking about is that the magazine gets put in, and then to rack it is, now at that point, this gun is hot. The, like there is a bullet in the chamber right now. If I were to turn the safety off, pull the trigger, the gun would go off. Now, to what happened with this gun is when they talk about when you're unloading it, you first drop the magazine out. So there's the rest of the bullets are here.
But there's still a round in the chamber.
Right. That right. other round is still in here. So in order to get rid of it, you rack it again, and I'm going to let it flop out. The gun's empty now. So here's this bullet. Now, that the mechanism in there would make a mark on this. Now, what you would do if you just you got home, you were carrying this gun, and now you pulled that bullet out, and take your magazine, and you put the bullet back into it, back into
just
the magazine.
Just to be clear, Zach is on the other side of Bob. It looks not, like they're
not, oh yeah,
pointing
the cameras are backwards.
The cameras are backwards. I am on the
no,
other side of the table.
No, he is not pointing a hot gun at Zach.
Even though the gun looks like it's facing me in the video,
thank
it's
you,
actually
thank
facing...
Thank you for caring, and thank you for that note, because gun safety is
pointed the opposite direction of Zach. Yeah, Zach is over there. So that's what they're talking about, racking the round. That's what we're talking about. That would be to eject it to come out. And that would be also, you know, kind of one of the theories that we had about why there would be an unspent round would be if they were now at this point, I do not have the magazine in there. It's clear there's no bullets in this gun, but something you see on TV, if they're trying to scare someone, you know, if they're like, all right, get down, and they, right. you know, do that to make that noise. There's one thing that I always thought could have been a reason why that round then popped out. Now, if the magazine was in here, it would have just loaded another bullet into that. It would have ejected one and loaded one into there. But that process that I just showed you, where he ejected that bullet, when they tested the unspent round from the crime scene, they weren't able to replicate those marks by doing that. They had to fire it, which is a different process. But in that case, instead of me doing this manually, racking the round, the pressure from when the bullet goes out, the explosion, the explosive force actually pulls this slide back like that, and that ejects the empty shell out of the gun. And that's the other thing, too. The bullet they're testing was a bullet that looked like this, a casing with a round in it. The one that they were able to get sufficient agreement on was an empty casing that did not have a bullet in it anymore because they fired it. They fired the bullet out of it. So hopefully, I know for you guys that are listening to
no,
this
that's
audio,
super
that
helpful.
Might be,
it just, super it's helpful. Just not the same. It's just not the same.
Different. Right.
That's not the test. You don't get to do that test. You don't get to do that.
The amount of force if you guys watch when he racked that gun and where that round went, it fell out directly in front of him when he racked that round.
It drizzled out.
It drizzled out, right. If he were to fire that, it would have been laying over here in my lap. And I'm 6 feet away from him.
Right.
I mean, it's a much different thing.
Also, so Chris asked, can I see the marks with my naked eyeballs? Yes, I can. I would show it. I don't think you'll be able to see it on the camera, but Zach will be able to see it. See what I'm talking about, the mark that it made from being ejected. I don't generally carry around like around in the chamber. So like mine hasn't been cycled a million times in and out of there. Yeah. I don't do that. I don't.
Right on the head stamp, you should see it.
There's a few little.
Well, there's one like groove right down the middle of the case, like right down the mm-hmm. the side of the casing from the mechanism going over it.
Yep.
But okay, I think we
beat that to death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we can move on from there. And again, for you guys who are listening to audio, I'll post that. I'll probably post this whole video, or I might just post a clip of that just so you guys can see what we're talking. Because I'm sure it'll be frustrating for the people just listening on Friday to this. For the patrons, you guys will see it.
I want to read Lynn. Lynn is a great friend of the show, big wrongful convictions advocate, and really leans guilty on this, and just has a little paragraph that, you know, reading it on its face, it's very compelling. And I wanted to acknowledge that and just quickly read it and just see if you have a response, Bob, that, it, you know, because I get it. Like, if you look at it like this, it feels like, however they got there, he's guilty. It does, you know, there you go. And she's definitely not advocating that anybody, you know, cheat or do it the wrong way. Lynn says, as an outsider to this case, I found that there are other facts that led me to conclude Alan is guilty. His very first statement to police the day after Bridge Guy's photo hit the news, he placed himself on the bridge. He knows he was seen there, wearing similar clothing at the time of the murders and using his phone. He had 17 older phones, but not that phone. He had attempted suicide with a gun in the past, causing his wife to call 911. The defense had a weaker expert regarding the spent casing, the timing of the four girls, the jogger, cars on video from Hoosier Harvest store. When laid out, became clear to me. At first, I thought maybe they had the wrong guy, but the timing lines up with Alan. he had a very good defense team.
So you want me to, so the kind of piece.
I mean, I guess you can't, I mean, I guess you can't no, litigate think, against every no, statement like in I 5 seconds, but.
It's pretty simple. I mean, the fact of the matter is that a vast majority, and I can tell you, I'm from the Midwest, and like I went to college in rural Illinois, like rural Indiana, which Delphi very much is. Carhartts, jeans and boots are kind of like standard fare. Like, I mean, that's just very common clothing for everybody to wear. So like, I don't take that as any kind of significant thing. To move on to the fact that he places himself at the scene. I mean, I want you to try to think back, and we're not talking about somebody who's committed a crime and has returned to the scene to see what's going on with his handiwork or to get the vibe of what he's done. We're talking about somebody who's voluntarily put himself at a scene where he knows that two girls were killed, theoretically at or around the time that the girls were killed. Like, I mean, can you think of anybody in any case ever that's done that? Like, and I'm not talking about somebody that's confessed to something after, you know, being interrogated for hours. I'm talking about voluntarily going and saying, hey, yeah, I was out there. This is what I was wearing. Here's the MEID from my phone. And so as far as that goes, I just don't find it. And there's a saying in the law, and it's actually the law, that mere presence is not enough. It's just not enough in this country. You can't convict somebody on mere presence. Otherwise, we'd all be in a shit ton of trouble for any crime that ever took place someplace that we were even near. You know, I mean, theoretically, we could be sucked into the vortex of, you know, the criminal justice system. But take that out of it. So my counter to that is he volunteered the information. Then when you look at the concept of the round, I disagree completely. I think that their expert was far more learned than Oberg was. I just do. I thought that, you know, and the big question from the jury was, why didn't you test the round yourself? And I can almost guarantee you that it was a time and or money issue, you know, because that would have been a thing. Like, I mean, you only have so many dollars to spend as a defense lawyer in terms of if the state's giving you or the state or the county is giving you money to hire experts. You have to kind of pick your poison in terms of where you're going to allocate your money. And, you know, it's commonly done where they don't actually go and do their own. I mean, because it's going to cost a lot more money to have your expert, because they're going to make them come in to the cop shop, wherever the evidence is. They're going to have to conduct the testing there. It's a whole thing. So it's not unusual to have, and it's not optimal. I mean, in a perfect world, in every case, we'd have each expert testing every piece of evidence, right? I mean,
right.
That's how we'd want it for every case, not just this case. So, you know, I mean, in terms of the fact that Gold didn't allow their metallurgy guy to come on, that was really going to blow her out of the water in terms of the testing that they're doing, which is something that is just highly subjective. It's a completely subjective analysis, and every single person can look at it and come up with a different conclusion. And you know, it's just not accepted. And there's never been a conviction where an unspent casing has been the primary piece of evidence in a case ever. Now, has there been cases that have existed where they've used unspent casings? Yes, but it wasn't the primary piece of evidence in the case. It was very much, in this case, it was really the reason he was arrested. If they don't have that casing, they don't arrest him. So those are your two pieces of evidence. Those are the only two things that exist. And I guess the other counter that I would have to, would you say it was Linda?
Lynn
is the fact that, like, why, if you're Richard Allen and you're out on the bridge and you know that you have been spotted by at least three different groups of people, because that's how many people testify that they saw him. Okay. Well, so that
they saw a guy.
Well, yeah, they saw bridge guy. Right. So why, if you're going in to say that you were out there, why are you, especially the witness who sees him out on the platform? Okay. Like, she got the best look at him. And he turned around and looked either past her. She said they never made direct eye contact. but he looked back towards her and then turned around. Like, if you're out there placing yourself at the scene, why are you intentionally skipping over people that you know saw you? Like, that doesn't resonate with me as something that someone would do, because you know that people had eyes on you. You know what I mean? You know that somewhere down the road, they're going to be talking to other people, because Richard Allen's no idiot. You know, I mean, you can hear how his mind works when he sniffs out the fact that they're trying to make him the fall guy within 5 minutes of the first interview. So, you know, it's like you kind of look at those things. And then the biggest argument that I've had with this case forever is just this assumption that the timeline is correct when they have zero evidence that this is when the girls were killed. They're basing their entire case in terms of when the girls were killed, when that phone is last shown to have moved, which was at 2:32 p.m. Yet you don't have any scientific evidence whatsoever from the medical examiner saying, okay, yeah, there was core body temperature that was taken when the girls were finally discovered. We worked our way back. This is what the temperature was. It gives us at least a range. We don't have that. We don't have the stomach contents. Why those came in from either side, I have no idea, because we know that they ate banana pancakes that morning. Bananas are pretty sturdy. They don't digest real quickly. They'll hang around in there for a while. So like those things would have been very, very helpful in establishing the timeline, because that's what I kept hollering. I'm like, on my lives, I'm like, if Allie and I are defending this case, we are attacking the timeline nonstop, because they just right. don't have a way. Like, if you're cramming it in to where the girls died at that time and you've got Allen there, it's a problem for the defense. And it's going to go to exactly what Lynn said. Most people are like, wait, you had him there at the time. No one else right. saw anyone else. They saw the car right. and the car thing. You know,
yeah, we don't have to. I mean, check out Defense Diaries.
Yeah, I mean,
Breakdown of a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's, and it's a fascinating argument. It's a fascinating debate, and I'm here to have it with anybody. I'm just saying that when you look at it from both sides, like Lynn kind of gave us the homogenized state's theory of the case without really examining, like, did Lynn really dig into the experts?
No, I mean, admittedly, she said as an outsider to this case. So she's, you know, she's acknowledging that she hasn't like dug deep in. If I could just clarify one quick thing, though, because this is something that has been bugging me. Where exactly did he place himself? Because did he say like, I went out onto the bridge. I was looking down, because you have to look down, because you've made the point. Yes. It's a big deal to cross that bridge. Like, people aren't necessarily just like, of course, 50 people loped across that bridge that day. No big deal. Where did he take himself to with respect to like that exact bridge?
It sounded like the first platform, which was probably, it was gone by the time I finally got out to the bridge. They had already like gotten rid of the first portion of the bridge and turned it into like something that people might not die off of. So there was like a concrete walk with railing. So I think what people have told me, it was about 20 feet out there, which was the first platform, which was obviously for railroad workers in the event that a train was coming back when it was an operational track. You know, they have to go somewhere, otherwise they're having to jump off the bridge. So they had that first one. So yeah, his statement was that he went out to that first platform, which is ultimately where he says that he was looking down at the fish, which the first thing I did when I got out to the bridge, I looked over to see if I could see fish. And even in mid-October, I saw fish swimming in there. Like, I don't know if they were big. They look like carps, kind of. They look kind of big to me. But, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like he was out there. He said he was out on the bridge. Like, what? Like, why are you putting yourself out on the bridge if you did this? You know, it's like, The argument has always been, oh, he's trying to get in front of it. You're pretending like that this person wouldn't have known that Libby had her phone pointing at Abby. He would have seen that. He would have seen that there was a phone there, you know, because what the state ended up turning it into is that both Abby and Libby were heroes. Libby was a hero for taking the video, and that Abby's last act was for her to hide the phone underneath her as she was dying. Like, that became the state's narrative. you know, and there's obviously no proof of that. There was no proof that her fingerprints were on that phone. They didn't substantiate.
It's a great emotional moment, though. I mean, you get why they did it, because it, yeah, 100%. It's very powerful.
If I would have done the exact same thing, if I'm Nick McLean,
yeah,
there's no better way, yeah, to close it, you know?
Did Anna wants to know, did an FBI profiler ever profile the murderer for this case? Do we know that? And that definitely dovetails with people saying, you know, when do you, I don't think you know, because I think you would have said, and I think you've been asked this before on your show, but people are like, when did they cut the FBI loose with respect to when they were zeroing in on Richard Allen? So FBI involvement, whether or not, you know, they actively like had a behavioral sciences person do a profile, that kind of thing. People are very curious about that involvement.
So BAU was involved early on. I think that they did kind of like your typical profile, you know, like, yeah, I think there one existed. They thought it was somebody that was familiar with the area, you know, middle-aged guy, you know, so like kind of a typical profile for these types of crimes. I always find them to be very similar. And maybe that's because that's typically who seems to commit these types of crimes.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I think one existed. And then Doug Carter aced the FBI in August of 2021. That's when he said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't need your technology, your resources, and your manpower anymore. So a year and some change.
I would love to hear the reason for that. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I would love, maybe there's a really, really strong reason for that. And I just would love to know what it is. But
yeah. And McLean had the opportunity to ask him that. Because the defense put Carter on to ask him that when they fired the FBI, when they uninvited the FBI from the party, and Carter gave the answer. And then McLean, and then he said, and you also made sure to get back all of the discovery that you tendered to them, right? You didn't leave them with anything. So they could not continue to work on it in any capacity, right? And he said, yeah, that's correct. So, which is weird. It's like, why are you inviting a far superior law enforcement agency with infinitely better technology, resources, and manpower from investigating this case with you? You know, why aren't you inviting them back to the party post-arrest so that they can do their exam? I mean, to me, it's like, it just on its face, it's more compelling to have the feds have one of their experts come in and testify at trial, sure. You know, and it's like they just, I don't know. It was weird.
Going back to Ellen saying, she's saying, if you don't believe that Richard Allen is Bridge Guy, and there are, regardless of where you fall on guilty or innocent, to me, the height issue is a real problem. There are definitely a lot of things about that make him being Bridge Guy very, very difficult. But there are also people who are like, oh, I look right at the video and I see that it's him and this height seems fine. So people very much differ on this. But Ellen says, you know, what do you have an idea of what you think makes sense to have happened? And for example, I would say I find the argument that there could be a second person there. You want to talk about lying in wait, someone on you flank them from both sides. I mean, that's what I think that would make sense. So do you feel like there's more than one person perhaps involved, and could there have been someone on the other side and both people are kind of closing in that way?
The problem is that they just couldn't make the connection. And, you know, people like to talk about, oh, and the other part about the 17 devices. So and I asked Kathy this question. I'm like, so they had way more than 17 devices. There was like 30 something or 23 devices, flash cards, flash drives, hard drives, tablets. Like they took all kinds of stuff. And so this phone that was missing, like, so that she would essentially recycle old phones, or they'd keep them if they, like, they didn't do a trade-in because they weren't, like, they use this Ting, some provider I never heard of. It's like, it sounds like a Cricket type deal, pay by the minute type thing. And they've been using that for years. And so, you know, I asked her, I'm like, well, what could have happened with that phone? She's like, I have no clue. I'm like, but like, I mean, the reality is if we broke the screen, we were never paying $200 to get the screens fixed. We just go get a new phone, and they weren't buying. Right. They were getting like Google Pixels. they weren't buying iPhones and expensive like droids. You know, they were just because they weren't getting plans through AT&T or Verizon, where like people that have iPhones typically pay through their carrier. You know, like I upgrade every 2 years or whenever the hell they bring out a new phone, and I'm paying constantly for my phone over time because I never buy it in cash. So, you know, in terms of why he didn't have the phone, it didn't really matter in terms of the data that they would have had from the actual phone company. Like the carrier would have had like his geolocation and all that stuff. You didn't, you know what I mean? It's like they had the ability to be able to get the information from the carrier theoretically. Now, whether or not they tried to do it, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like, those were the things where you're looking at the integrity of the investigation that you're asking yourself, okay, well, why didn't they do that? Why didn't they shore up their case by getting his phone records, or at least being able to put somebody on the stand and say, okay, yeah, we tried to get our, you know, Alan's phone records from Ting, but we're going to put this witness on and they're going to say, well, we only keep them for X amount of years. And they were gone by the time they made the arrest. You know what I mean? Somebody right. to at least explain that, yes, we tried to get it, but we didn't. And we just never got any answers as to that. So like the phone itself, to me, it doesn't appear that he was trying to hide the phone. Like when he takes his battery out and shows it to Doolin and Doolin writes down the MEID, like that's not a dude that's like, why isn't, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's one of those things like, cause like when I was thinking about the phone thing, when that came out, I'm like, all right, like what could have happened to the phone? I mean, that's going to be a problem for a jury because in their minds they're going to be like, all right, the guy got rid of the phone, smoking gun evidence. Like why? But like he gets rid of the phone, but he keeps the gun. He keeps the jacket. And, you know, I mean, like the things like he doesn't leave town for 5 years. Like there's like so many counterintuitive things to me that just don't make any sense in terms of somebody that would have committed this type of crime. To like hiding in plain sight like that, like where you're working in a small town at the only pharmacy, really the biggest store of note in.
That's ballsy as hell.
I mean, it's super ballsy. And, you know, just like so ultimately I have no idea what happened. And, you know, the question becomes like, could it have been Alan with somebody else? Well, I mean, they would have found some kind of trace somewhere because they were desperately trying to connect him with Kagan Klein. You know, they were desperately trying to connect him with anybody, with the Odin dude, anybody.
Also, partner, give him up.
Right.
I mean, he would give him up. I mean, if he confessed 60 times and he was eating his own poop.
100%.
Like, how was he a mastermind who's like, the one thing I'm going to do is protect my friend? Like that is inconceivable to me. Like you can't, that, to me, that doesn't make intellectual sense.
It would never.
It would have come out. Like that definitely would have come out.
And guys, I am going to, for the first time ever, have to be the adult in the room and say,
we actually have covered a ton of this.
The last time too.
I know. We have covered so much of this, Valeria and Lilius. I hope that you feel like, even though, you know, we didn't read your questions verbatim, there's Sarah about, you know, Indiana and bringing the third party defense. We absolutely have touched on as much of this as we could. That basically just leaves us with questions that I don't think you have the answers to yet, but just to acknowledge that our listeners are obviously very avid. They want to stay involved. They're curious. Jennifer wants to know when the evidence will be made available to the public. How can they follow and potentially help raise money for a request to get copies if that's in the ether, if that's happening with people, and then the writ that Andrea filed to gain audio. So that's just the general swell from the Truth and Justice Army is saying, how do we get involved? What do we do?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, I know that they're going to be creating a fund if they can for appellate lawyers. He's going to need some really good appellate lawyers. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of issues in the case, and you want to go through the process where that this portion of the process is honest. You know, like if they go through it and if he has to be retried, and let's have it done proper so that we can all feel comfortable with the verdict. You know what I mean? It's like, you just never want to be sitting here wondering, You know, and it's a thing with circumstantial cases, right? I mean, you're always kind of in that position where you can feel adamant, but you don't know. No, you know what I mean?
And guys, we can't. Yeah, totally.
You guys are not letting me be the adult.
Let me say one last thing, and then I'll go. And I am going to be late to my friend's thing. But I was going to say that I love the conversation that you had with Kara and Michael, maybe, or if I'm remembering their names, that was a while ago. But you hosted a great conversation with two appellate lawyers who have very different opinions about how you should go about attacking this case. I thought it was fascinating. Highly recommend it. You guys can check it out on the Defense Diaries YouTube page. I'm done. Bob Ruff, apologies. I knew this was going to happen.
And now. This is, it's goodbye. Not very often that I get to step in. Janet's the one that keeps us in line. We're past Janet's deadline, 20 minutes past when she needs to go. We're an hour and 12 minutes into
Thanks
this.
Thanks for hanging with us, Janet.
Yeah.
I forgot. Yeah.
Will you two shut the fuck up?
Oh my goodness.
We're gonna wrap this up, and thanks Bob and Janet for being here.
Love it.
What I was gonna say is there's so many more questions that everybody has, and what I'm gonna direct everybody to do is go to the Defense Diaries, to Bob's YouTube channel. They're live all the time. He's got his podcast, him and his wife Allie, both attorneys, both great, tons of information. And they have Facebook groups and other groups you can get into and ask a lot of these questions. Bob and Allie are definitely your sources for doing that. Moving forward, like I said, I have reached out to, we may bring somebody else on just to get another perspective. If anybody gets back to me, I'll reach out to the Murder Sheets, like you guys asked. We'll see what they say. As far as us, what we're going to be doing this Sunday, we're gonna hear an episode from a friend of mine named Ryan Wolf, who hosts the podcast called Guilt. It's a podcast out of New Zealand. He does a real-time active investigation work, very similar to what we do. He's done some amazing things there. And as I mentioned kind of last week, then kind of in the interim here, while we're kind of wrapping Jody's case and getting prepped for another season, I want to highlight podcasters that are out there that are doing real work in the space and trying to make a difference in the world. Ryan fits that bill that Sunday. And then for our patrons, for everybody, next Sunday, for our patrons this Sunday, I believe at 1:30 p.m. Eastern time, check out the Patreon page. But I did get a taker, one of our listeners named Molly, who is not, doesn't describe herself as being in the guilty camp as far as Jody's case, but is definitely in the camp of not convinced of Jody's innocence and has some points that she thought that she could make and we could have a good discussion. So awesome. Molly is going to be joining me. We're going to be doing a live stream for our patrons on Sunday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern time. That conversation will air as an episode the following Sunday. So that's what we got coming up the next 2 weeks. And with that being said, we're going to pull the plug on this one. Go check out the Defense Diaries. Thanks, Bob. And Allie, thank you for being in the chat and all the work that you guys do. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Love you guys. Thanks.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.